This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an evening of contemporary ballet or an immersive play set in Reconstruction-era New Orleans, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The Marigny Opera Ballet continues its sixth season with a groundbreaking work by legendary dancer-choreographer Paul Taylor as it presents Oriole and a world premiere by one of its own, New Orleans-based dancer-choreographer Gretchen Erickson's Dialogues in G Major. Artistic director Dave Hurlburt is here. Welcome.
Hi, Diane.
This must be a very exciting time for you as you are performing a classic work by Paul Taylor. Tell us about your special connection with the late legendary dancer and how your ballet company got the honor of performing his 1962 masterpiece.
My partner, Scott King, and I have been involved with the Paul Taylor Dance Company in New York for over 10 years. In fact, Scott is on the board and has been on the board for all of that time. Over the past decade, we've gotten to know really all of the dancers, the executive director, and they've become friends. I love Paul Taylor's works. And I wanted to honor his memory. He passed away 2 years ago by performing one of his ballets here in New Orleans. And I think that now that we're in our sixth season, our dancers are ready for it. I started conversations with the folks at Paul Taylor and asked permission to do this. And they readily agreed. And we now have James Sampson, who was a star at Paul Taylor, who is recently retired, here in New Orleans setting the work on the Marigny Opera Ballet.
Wow. Let's talk a little about Paul Taylor, who actually started dance pretty late in life. I believe he was in his 20s and went on to become this iconic choreographer and dancer.
He was a swimmer.
A swimmer.
And went to a dance festival, though, out of curiosity, I guess, and was discovered instantly by Martha Graham, the legendary choreographer, and actually joined the Graham Company for a while before starting his own group.
Now, he's known for his athleticism, unique moves, and humor in dance. Tell us a little about his movement style.
Mr. Taylor's style is certainly athletic and open, and I would say fairly dramatic at times. He's done so many ballets. He's created, I believe, 144 modern dances, and I would say 20 or 30 of them are classics, and Oriole is one of the most iconic from 1962. Mr. Taylor started out as an avant-garde choreographer, and he liked to shock his audiences. He did one famous piece where he and a woman simply sat on the stage and listened to dial tone for, I don't know what, 3 minutes or something. And the next day, the newspapers in New York reviewed it. One of the reviewers responded by saying, Paul Taylor's new work, and the column was completely blank.
That was his minimalist period, maybe?
I would say that's as minimal as you can get. Oriole, in fact, was intended to be an avant-garde piece. It was, I believe, intended to shock people at the time. Modern dance back in 1962 was a very serious affair. Always serious, always to contemporary abstract kind of music. So Paul decided to use the music of George Frideric Handel, Baroque music. Unthinkable.
A modern dance piece.
And to make matters worse, in white costumes. You know, the cliche back then was if you were doing modern dance, it was going to be in black. So he told his dancers before they performed it during the premiere, the curtain call has to be really fast because we're not going to get any applause. So you got to come on and go off. Well, they premiered it, and they did shock some of the dance enthusiasts of the day who thought this was too iconoclastic. I mean, how dare you perform something to Baroque music? Why don't you use new music? And Paul's response was, it's new to me. So what happened was the audience wouldn't stop clapping. It was an instant hit, and it's been an iconic dance that's been in the repertoire there ever since.
Now, when I think of the word Oriole, the image of a halo comes to my mind. What is Paul Taylor exploring in the work?
Mr. Taylor almost never explained any of his works. He resisted doing that. You were supposed to get your meaning by watching it, because it's a dance. It's not a literary thing. I've spent the last 20 years watching Paul Taylor trying to get my own meaning out of the dances. And what I think the aureole is, which is a halo, what that represents in this piece, maybe more than any of his others, represents goodness and joy. It's filled with goodness. And I think the dancers appear to be something like gods and goddesses, crossing and crossing the stage. We're told that the wings are very important in this piece because this ballet is supposed to be danced in infinity, in infinite space. So you'll see dancers using the wings, running off and on, and then back through another wing throughout the entire piece.
Also on the program is a premiere by Marigny Opera Ballet dancer, choreographer Gretchen Erickson, Dialogues in G Major. What was the inspiration for this dance?
She wanted to do a dance to one of the Bach cello suites, just a solo cello. So she and I listened to all of them, trying to determine which one to use. The first cello suite in G Major is by far the best known. So at first she was reluctant to consider using it. It's been used by other choreographers in the past. But we talked about how that would be a challenge. Can you use this music and make it fresh? And that's what she's done.
So what is the discussion being examined in the work?
It's about conversations, internal conversations, and actual dialogues, interpersonal conversations, and also conversations with the audience. She's looking at relationships with yourself, with a loved one, with a stranger, and with the audience.
Tell us a little bit about Gretchen Erickson.
Gretchen has been with the Marigny Opera Ballet now. It's her fifth season. She's one of our principal dancers. This is the third piece she'll have choreographed for us. Her first piece, Searching for Ethos, was done several years ago. The second one, Silk and Smoke, was up for a Gambit Award.
I remember that one, yes.
And has actually been performed in Chicago. All of these pieces are short pieces, 20-minute dances. Gretchen grew up in Louisiana, but she spent a lot of time in London and in Europe. She was trained there, and she toured. She toured England and Europe when she was a member of the Transitions Dance Company. After our first season was over, I received an email from her out of the blue, from London, asking about our company. She was considering moving back to Louisiana. She sent us an audition clip, and we decided on the spot that she looked great, and we wanted to hire her, and she moved back to New Orleans and joined the company in our very second season.
Now, do the two works on the program, Gretchen's Dialogues in G Major and Paul Taylor's Aureole, they were created nearly six decades apart. Mm-hmm. Do they complement each other in some way?
They do. What they have in common is Baroque music. Other than that, Gretchen's choreography is quite different from Paul Taylor's choreography. Gretchen uses a fairly contemporary and fresh style, whereas Aureole, to us today, we would say that's classical modern dance.
How are you hoping audiences will be moved by these dances?
I'm hoping they're going to consider their own relationships, watching Gretchen's piece, with themselves and with whoever they're with in the theater, perhaps. And I'm hoping that the audience watching Aureole will be filled with goodness and joy. I think this is a perfect ballet for us to watch during these times.
Marigny Opera Ballet Artistic Director Dave Herbert, thanks so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Performances of Paul Taylor's Aureole and Gretchen Erickson's Dialogues in G Major run January 31st through February 2nd at the Marigny Opera House, 725 St. Ferdinand Street. More info is online at marignyoperaballet.org. In the interest of full disclosure, I am a member of the Marigny Opera Foundation Board. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Race and class divisions are exposed in Goat in the Road Productions' new immersive play, The Uninvited. The work, set in Reconstruction-era New Orleans and staged inside the Gallier House, is based on historical events. Director Chris Kamenstein and writer Denise Frazier are here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us, Dan.
There is a lot to unpack in your new play, The Uninvited. What was the inspiration for this immersive production?
Well, the inspiration sprang out of our need to tell the stories of the Gulf South, of this region, especially during the time of Reconstruction. And because this theme of white terrorism, racialized violence, inequalities, disparate social inequities in the city are so pervasive, we wanted to not only look back, but to make something that could be relevant to today's time as well.
We were really interested in Reconstruction-era New Orleans for our last production, which Denise helped write and was in as well, called The Stranger Disease. And this time through, we knew we wanted to look at the same era, but we were wanting to find a different story to tell. That piece was about yellow fever in 1878 New Orleans. And this time through, we made a connection with Lawrence Powell, the author of The Accidental City and an amazing historian in town. And he brought to us a Harper's article about this incident at the LaLaurie Mansion next door to the Gallier House, about an attempt by the White League to forcibly segregate integrated schools in 1874 New Orleans. And we felt like that was sort of a remarkable and unknown incident in our city's history that we could draw on to try to make these characters in the house have to make tough decisions. And that feels like the center of great drama. This is something I didn't know much about until we started this research, which is at that time in Reconstruction era New Orleans and in Louisiana, it was mandated that schools be integrated. And so there were integrated schools all over the city.
This is 1874.
That's right. Yeah. And this law, if I'm not mistaken, was passed as early as 1868. So there were a number of years of integrated schooling. And there was obviously push and pull in the city. This particular time period in December 1874, the White League tried to take action at about 8 different schools around the city and segregate them by pulling out the students that they thought were of color. And again, I think it's an incident that speaks both to the progressiveness of that integrated state government at the time, which did have both black and white politicians. And it's also an incident that we collectively often overlook and know so little about. And I'll include myself in that as well.
What is the significance of staging this work in the Gallier House Museum?
We very much were working from the information we had about the women who lived in that house at the time. So 3 of the characters are Aglae Gallier, who's the matriarch of the household, and 2 of her daughters. Aglae was the widow of James Gallier Jr., and her 2 daughters are of marrying age, and she's really intent for economic and social reasons to make sure they get married. And so that animates a big part of the story as well. So we were collaborating closely with them to make this show not only about the incident we mentioned, but also about the history that we know of in the Gallier Historic House.
So, Denise, take us inside this immersive experience.
The experience of immersive theater is all-encompassing. You don't have any boundaries. You're able to really understand what the characters do in private. You're able to understand what they do when no one is watching. It's not like a typical theater where you would sit down and you would face the actors. You're able to go into all kinds of different spaces and understand how they really live their lives. The Gallier House is filled with objects that represent the wealth that the Galliers had. There's several statues, there's paintings, but there's also this underlining racialized tension in racialized spaces. We have the actors of African descent who clearly have spaces in the house, whether that's in the upstairs part where they reside and live to directly downstairs where they work in the kitchen and the pantries. And so these spaces really represent where one is allowed and where one is not allowed. And in terms of present day audiences, it's striking, emotionally striking, to be able to traverse these spaces that we may or may not have been allowed to traverse over a century ago.
There are multiple scenes happening in the house at the same time. There might be a scene up in the bedroom, there's a scene in the kitchen, there's a scene in the parlor, all happening simultaneously. As an audience member, no one tells you, go to here or see this. You decide, I'm going to go to the kitchen for a while, I'm going to catch this scene, or I'm going to follow this character for the entire time, or I'm going to go and just stand in this room. And sometimes people will come in, and sometimes people will leave, and sometimes you'll be there alone. No one interacts with the audience directly, so you can be an observer in that mode. The other thing to know about the show is that it's a 45-minute cycle that happens twice. So maybe the first time through, you're up in the bedroom and you catch a bunch of scenes there, but you missed all the stuff in the kitchen. Well, now on the second cycle, that same thing will happen again, and you can go to the kitchen and catch the other half of the story. So it's really immersive in that way. Wear flats or something you can move around in. There are benches to sit on in scenes, but it is mobile.
Let's flesh out the characters.
One of my favorite characters, I would have to say, is Moses, who is a journalist, someone of African descent, who kind of represents some of the important strides that people of African descent were making at the time. And as Chris indicated, there was integration in terms of politics in the city. There was people of African descent that were able to vote. And of course, when there's these strides that people who were formerly oppressed are making, there's a backlash, and the White League sort of represents that. He brings a news clipping that the writing team actually found. There are more writers on this team besides myself, that told the story of a young woman who was a teacher who was killed by the White League in Louisiana, Julia Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
This woman was a part of the new integration of school system, and she was brutally killed. And she's just one person. There's so many other people who have experienced that. So this character brings that story into the fold, and it really just hits home the level of extreme danger that a lot of the characters of African descent were in. That's just one character out of so many. There's also a character of Irish descent played by Dylan Hunter. Moses is played by Brian
Eagland.
And Dylan's character is Irish, and he's sort of navigating this this weird liminal space of the Irish formerly being known as black and treated as a second-class citizens in the 1800s to integrating themselves into whiteness, in quotes. And so that character has a lot to negotiate with. And so it's interesting to see them battle with this kind of privilege of appearing a certain way, of passing for white, but also being Irish and not being considered as white in that time. So those are just two examples.
Other characters are Agley Gallier, her daughters, Leonie and Blanche, who are her two eldest daughters in the house. There's Charity, who's an amazing figure, who in the house is the cook, but has been someone who helped, in our story, found Donaldsonville, which was one of the first black political enclaves post-war. Renee, who's sort of a black market salesperson, sells contraceptives on the side and is the lady's maid in the house. Rose, who's the school teacher next door and Charity's cousin. And then we have Eamon McCarty, who Denise mentioned, who's an Irish man who's coming to court Blanche, and Jarvis, who's a member of the White League. And so it's a lot of different people from different, you know, racial backgrounds and class backgrounds coming together in this moment and having to navigate this incident.
And I think that a lot of people will see themselves reflected in this show, and it'll be hard to see.
There's definitely moments where it can feel like you almost forget that it's 150 years ago, especially when people are talking about the political realities of the time. The arguments can be eerily similar. I'll also say, you know, I think one of our values as a company is both that we're talking about something that feels historic and important and really rich, and also that there's humor and song and grace in there. So you'll see the very first scene of the play is, you know, Charity and Rose sitting around and making crude jokes at the expense of the other people in their lives. And you'll see the Gallier women have an entire scene about their love of Little Women and Louisa May Alcott, and you'll hear people sing. So there's a lot of different textures in there so that audiences can see the variety of life at the time, the way that people entertained each other.
Yeah, I think that's a cool part about this show and that Goat on the Road Productions writing in general, is that there is a deep sense of real humanity. It's not just complete danger and awful things happening and incredible racism. These are also just people just living their lives. And I think that's part of the joy also of seeing this show and the sense of resistance. Like, despite the fact that some of these characters of African descent were going through so much, they're also human beings enjoying each other's company, loving each other. And so it's really great to work with a company that is very focused on nuance and on getting as real of a picture as we can.
How are you hoping modern audiences will move the ball forward in making better choices for humanity?
I think that empathy can allow people to re-examine the choices that we make on a daily basis and examine them in the context of thinking about whether they're living the values that we purport or not. And I think that can be the way that this show has an effect on people.
I also know that the actors themselves and the writers just going through this immersive experience are also changing the way that we view the world.
Director Chris Kamenstein and writer Denise Frazier, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Goat in the Roads Immersive Production, The Uninvited, in collaboration with Herman Grima and Gallier Historic Houses, runs through February 14th at the Gallier House, 1132 Royal Street. More info is online at hggh.org. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Le Petit Theatre. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack. We'll be right back.